From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Some of today's hottest political debates stem from disagreements that go back to the earliest days of the American Republic. We'll learn why with the help of a renowned Georgetown University constitutional law professor. Despite a veto from Governor Roy Cooper, North Carolina lawmakers still want to combine the state boards that oversee elections and ethics enforcement. You'll hear debate on that topic. A recent Duke University lecture targeted the topic of pharmaceutical freedom. You'll learn what that means. And we'll hear the latest developments in the Raise the Age campaign. It involves 16 and 17-year-old criminal offenders. You'll learn why some believe these people belong in the juvenile justice system, not adult court. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper has signed into law a bill that gives school officials flexibility in dealing with cutting the number of children who are in each K through 3 classroom. The law is a culmination of a contentious debate over seats and funding. Dr. Terry Stoops has been following this debate in the General Assembly. He joins us now. He, of course, is Vice President for Research and the Director of Education Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
For a number of years now, as I recall the debate from school officials, there were cries for needing to have fewer children in each classroom. And now we reach the point where that actually was a proposal in the General Assembly, but there was a problem with it. So what was the problem? Why was it even debated?
Well, the problem is really due to the way that we fund our public schools. And the way that the funding was set up was there was always extra padding added to the budget based on a formula that was used to fund classroom teaching positions. That padding was taken out, thus leaving funding for elective positions, essentially music and art teachers, sort of by the wayside. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen with funding for them. So in order to try to ensure that we had a year's of funding left for those teachers, there were some adjustments that had to be made to the class size ratio. I know it's kind of hard to explain that there is some sort of relationship to our class sizes and the way we fund public schools. And I think that's probably the bigger issue here is that Republicans, of course, have been trying to lower class size in grades K-3, but they have to sort of decouple that from the way that we fund public schools, thus allowing schools to have money for those extra elective teachers as well as classroom teachers.
In fact, I think you several weeks ago had pointed out in The Locker Room, which is the John Locke Foundation's online blog, that there was even one school system that put out a video using the children saying, please don't cut our arts teachers and things like that. So it got pretty interesting, that debate.
It did. And unfortunately, a lot of these issues about how the funding is tied to the class size fell by the wayside just because it's so complicated to explain. But the basics are essentially what we needed to do was we needed to give a little more class size flexibility for the upcoming year to ensure that all the funding was in place for those extra teachers. And that's what the Republicans did in this bill, is to take care of that short-term issue, to give that flexibility for another year. And they're going to look at the funding issues that are related to that in future years. The long-term issue was figuring out where the money went. For years, Republicans have been giving additional funding for schools to lower class sizes in grades K through 3. And when they asked school districts to account for where that money has went, how many teachers were in the classroom, and what the class sizes looked like, many school districts had trouble providing that information. And so what Republicans thought that they would do very wisely, I might add, is to add provisions in this bill that have a reporting requirement for school districts so that the public knows where this money is going, knows what class sizes look like at the school school level and at the district level, and are better able to ascertain whether school systems are spending the money for class size reduction in grades K through 3 wisely.
Does this mean, Terry, that folks who have kids in a North Carolina public school who are either in kindergarten, first, second, or third grade, that next year there's going to be a smaller class size that their child is attending?
Yeah, this is where it gets complicated because we are talking about average class sizes. And that means that when you get into an actual classroom, you find class sizes of all different numbers. It depends on any number of factors, the number of teachers in the school, the number of special needs students, whether those students require accommodations, and scheduling. I remember when I was a classroom teacher, just because of scheduling, I would have one class that had 18 kids in it, another class with 32 kids, and it had nothing to do with the kids themselves. It had everything to do with scheduling, what other classes they were taking, whether they were signed up for an honors class or a regular class, and what lunch period they had. Those are all factors in what class sizes look like at the classroom level, actual class sizes. Here we're talking about averages, and so you find that when you look at just averages, it can be misleading because you have class sizes in some instances that far exceed the average, and you have class sizes in other instances that are far below the average.
Why such a focus on kids in K through 3?
This is an important reform that's been advanced by the Republicans for the last 5 or 6 years, is a focus on grades K through 3. We have a great deal of research that tells us that if kids are not successful by third grade, they will not be successful later on in their academic career, and one may argue even beyond that. The research says that they are less likely to graduate, less likely to go to college, and less likely to have a steady job in the workforce if they're not literate, if they're not reading at grade level by third grade. And so Republicans thought that the best approach to ensure that kids are able to read at grade level third grade is to make sure that class sizes remain low, as well as some other initiatives that they had. So the focus has really been on grades K through 3. The research is not so clear when it comes to grades 4 through 12. There's some research that says that class sizes matter, but in order for the class size to have an effect on student achievement, you'd have to get it down to, say, 14 students for every teacher. And in that case, the cost becomes so high to not only hire the teachers, but to have the space to be able to kind of accommodate those classes, that it's really not cost effective. So they have focused on grades K through 3, and I think they've done so in a very wise way.
That's really incredible what you just said. I mean, we're talking about very young kids here. If someone is in second or third grade, they're what, 7, 8, 9 years old perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
And we can tell that at that point, at that early point in their school careers, whether or not they're likely to succeed?
Yes. And the research, we've had research that shows this for several years. In fact, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has been one in the forefront that have looked at the relationship between third grade reading outcomes and outcomes later on in eighth grade and in high school. And the relationship is very clear. Now, there's also some other factors that play a role, socioeconomic status. Sometimes race will play a role, although socioeconomic status, really where the kids are as far as their parental income, their household income, makes a difference. But it just shows you how critical reading skills are. In fact, not only reading and math skills are in those early grades, because what happens is that if they don't get the skills in those grades, the gaps widen as they get older, and students start to disengage when they're in middle school because they feel like they can't catch up. So it just shows you how critical those early years are, and this is really the crux of the reason why that the Republicans have chosen to focus their reform efforts on the early grades.
There have been other initiatives, and you referenced that. I recall one having to do with like teachers teaching other teachers how to teach reading, and perhaps that's why that's so important, because of this research. that shows this connection with reading?
That's right. Teacher training is absolutely critical, and I think that's the next frontier for Republicans, is now that they've had all these measures in place for these early career teachers, I think it's absolutely essential for them to look at teacher training and to ensure that those early year teachers, those that are in the elementary grades, are prepared.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many of today's most heated political debates involve fundamentally different views of the role of the United States Constitution. And those different views aren't new. They reflect disagreements that go back to the earliest days of the United States of America. Our next guest examines the history of those disagreements in a book titled Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. The author of that book is Randy Barnett, professor of constitutional law at the Georgetown University Law Center and director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So we all know that that we're very politically divided in the United States. Your book, Our Republican Constitution, says shouldn't surprise anyone who's looked at the history and sees these long-standing debates about how our government should be run, including what the Constitution means. Were you surprised to see how divisive things have become in recent years?
No, not at all. I mean, I think not only are we divided as a people amongst the two conceptions of the Constitution I describe in my book, the Republican conception and the Democratic conception, but most people are actually divided within themselves about this. That is, most people carry around within them a Democratic conception of the Constitution and an inconsistent Republican conception of the Constitution. They tend to favor one when it comes out for them one way, and they favor the other when it comes the other way. So we can talk about what that is, and hopefully if I describe these things accurately, I'll describe what your listeners and viewers recognize about themselves.
Yeah, let's talk about those. So two fundamentally different conceptions. What are they?
Right. They're based on two different notions of popular sovereignty, which is the idea that it's we the people who are the sovereign. And these are two different notions of popular sovereignty based on two different conceptions of we the people. If you view we the people as a group, and then you say what popular sovereignty means is that we the people as a group are entitled to rule, then the only thing that could possibly mean is that a majority is entitled to rule. Rule according to the people's will must be the will of the majority, because you can't have rule by everybody. And then what we need is a constitution, a democratic constitution, that will provide the structure by which the will of the people will be expressed, oftentimes in the form of representative legislatures. And in fact, legislatures could be thought to represent the will of we the people on a microcosm basis. And so we need a democratic constitution to represent the will of we the people. And if you have that view, then the role of judges in such a regime is kind of problematic, because judges are not elected and they don't represent the will of the people, are not supposed to. And so here's the idea that judges should not get in the way, if they can possibly help it, of the will of the democratic majority. That's the democratic conception of we the Constitution, based on a collective view of we the people.
And now, there's an individual view as well.
Right. Well, I mean, if once I've said this, somebody in the audience is likely to say, well, of course that's right. What else could there be? And now I'm going to describe the other one, and I predict that your listener is going to say, oh, yeah, well, I guess I think that too. And the other one is the individual view of we the people. It still starts with popular sovereignty, but it views we the people as individuals, each of whom are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That may sound familiar to your audience. All those rights, by the way, are individual rights. The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness each belong to the individual. And then the book focuses on the next sentence of the Declaration of Independence, which says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So first come rights, and then comes government to secure these rights. This vision of government is a government as the servants of the people. We hire the government is not us. They don't necessarily represent our will any more than the garbage people who come, that we pay to come collect our garbage reflects us and our will, except our will that we want the garbage gone. We delegate the responsibility of disposing of our trash to a subset of us, and government is a subset of us. They are what we might call the agents, or how's this, the servants of we the people. There's an archaic way of looking at government. They're the servants of we the people, and they're tasked with a job, accomplish certain beneficial public ends, but first and foremost, secure the rights retained by the people. That's what the Declaration tells us. Now, if you take this view, what we need a constitution for, a Republican constitution, is on the one hand to empower the government to do what it needs to do, but on the other hand to constrain its power so it doesn't violate the rights that it's been created to secure, which is the individual rights of each and every one of us. Under this view of the Constitution, judges fit in quite nicely because judges themselves are agents or servants of the people, and they have a job to do. And their job is to be a fair and impartial magistrate. When a member of the sovereign public, us, we the people, an individual, comes into conflict with one of their agents or servants, a judge is supposed to be an independent tribunal of justice in order to adjudicate fairly a dispute that the citizen has that says, you know, you and the government, you've exceeded your just powers in the words of the Declaration, and the judge should be neutral. And so the fact that the judge doesn't represent the will of the people is actually a good thing because we don't want the judges to be biased in favor of one party or the other. That's the Republican Constitution. So here's what ends up happening. When the majority is on your side, people like to assert the will of the people and get mad at judges for getting in the way. Now, when the majority is not on your side, people talk about the tyranny of the majority, and they hope the judges will be there to protect their rights against those tyrannies. So those are the two competing conceptions we carry within us. This book is an argument for why the Republican conception is the right one and the Democratic conception is not.
That is the voice of Randy Barnett, professor of constitutional law at the Georgetown University Law Center, also director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. You just mentioned your book argues for the small r, Republican view, rather than the small d, Democratic view. Why do you say the Republican view of the Constitution is the better one?
Because I think the Declaration is right. We start with the rights. I believe that's true. These are individual rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Or the book talks about the fact that James Mason's draft of the Declaration of Rights was actually the more canonical formulation of these rights, which includes, for example, the right of property. And government is correctly viewed as our servants. And so we need a constitution to protect us from our servants, to ensure that they don't exceed their proper powers. And so that's what we need judges for. I think that's right. And the reason I wrote the book is because as I describe in the book, I was involved in the challenge to Obamacare. I'm the one that formulated the argument for why the individual insurance mandate is right. And you normally, if you win on the law, you win in the case. And we actually got 5 votes for our view that the individual insurance mandate was correct. And yet, as some of you may know, we lost in the sense that John Roberts, who agreed with us about the law, said nevertheless he was going to uphold the law. Well, how did he do that? He did that by reinterpreting the mandate so that it wasn't a mandate, and then he could uphold the law. He called that a saving construction. And the reason he justified that – the way he justified that is by saying he had to defer to the Democratic majoritarian Congress to do that, which taught me that it's not enough to be right on the law. You also have to be right on the role of judges. And this is a book about the proper role of judges in a republic, which is what we have.
Our time is running short, but if people read this book, what do you hope that they will take away with them as they approach who they're electing, who they want to see as judges? What's the proper response you hope they'll have to this?
Well, when you evaluate a nominee, you want to ask two things about him. One is, does he interpret the Constitution in the right way, which would be to give it its original meaning? And the second is, does he feel that he as a judge has the responsibility and indeed the duty to enforce that meaning against the more majoritarian branches?
That is the voice of Randy Barnett, professor of constitutional law at the Georgetown University Law Center, director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, author of the book we've been discussing, Our Republican Constitution, and also the lecturer at NC State University delivering the annual John W. Pope Lecture. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Despite a veto from Governor Roy Cooper, North Carolina lawmakers are moving forward with a new bipartisan 8-member body to oversee state elections and ethics enforcement. Republican Representative David Lewis defended the plan to his colleagues.
The intent of having bipartisan administration, consistent administration of ethics and elections remains the same. It is my firm belief that this bill provides a good pathway forward so that each and every person, and I'm speaking specifically to the governor's objection letter now, that each and every person can fully participate in the election process and exercise their constitutional right to vote. This bill is an idea that this body in one form or another has considered since 2011. This bill provides that there will be bipartisan administration of elections. This bill provides that there will be consistent interpretations of the law between elections and ethics issues.
House Democratic leader Darren Jackson fears North Carolina's new board will mirror the Federal Election Commission.
Three Republicans vote one way and three Democrats vote one another, and nothing gets done. And that's what you're doing to our elections board by doing this. You're making sure that there's deadlock and dysfunction in our elections board. And I think that that's the intention behind this bill, is that things won't get done. And because the default is, of course, is the statutory minimum number of early voting hours. It's the statutory minimum number of voting sites. The defaults are against voting. And so when people can't agree, that'll be the default. And I think that's by design. I think this is a bad bill. I think this is just going to lead to more lawsuits. And, of course, when the governor is challenging the legislature in court, taxpayers are paying for the court system and the court time. Taxpayers are paying for the attorneys on the governor's side. Taxpayers are paying for the attorneys on the legislator's side. And they're just losers all the way around.
The Republican Lewis disputed the Democrats' remarks.
I know this can work. I know that the people that will be selected by the governor and put on this board will be able to work together because they, like I, believe that the right to vote is one of the most sacred rights that we hold, and they will make sure that it is carried out. They understand the responsibility of administering ethics law in a fair and impartial way, and they will make sure that it is carried out. We need to pass this legislation.
That's Republican State Representative David Lewis defending a new bipartisan state elections and ethics board. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Governments should do a better job of protecting patients' rights when they set policies related to drugs. That's one of the key themes University of Richmond professor Jessica Flanagan made during a recent speech at Duke. Flanagan's Hayek lecture tackled the topic pharmaceutical freedom. She based it on a particular right.
The right of self-medication, which is an old right, and I'm seeking to revive it because I think that it's been mistakenly forgotten in our language about rights. I think that our existing system of pharmaceutical regulation violates these rights of self-medication. So prescription requirements, existing approval policies, so pre-market approval policies for new drugs, policies that stand between patients and access to pharmaceuticals violate their rights to make decisions about their own bodies. In general, it's wrong to disrespect a person's authority to make intimate and personal bodily decisions. And drug regulations do that. So those drug regulations are wrong.
Flanagan argues that drug approval policies violate rights. She says they also lead to bad health outcomes.
The first way that these policies have bad health effects is called drug loss. And that means that because the approval process currently takes, 5 to 8 years, billions of dollars, it's very difficult to bring a new drug to market. Because it's so difficult to bring a new drug to market, it raises the barrier to innovation. So there's an economist, Frank Lichtenberg, that looks at the benefits of pharmaceutical innovation over the 20th century and says that it's one of the primary contributors to life expectancy. There's ample evidence that as you increase the cost of approval, it decreases the rate of innovation. And as you decrease the cost of approval, such as with the 92 Prescription Drug User Fee Acts or the Orphan Drug Acts, which encouraged people to invest in rare diseases, you increase innovation. And so there's a direct link between costly approval processes and less pharmaceutical innovation. And less pharmaceutical innovation, we have reason to believe, costs lives. It also costs money that could be devoted to other medical causes, because one of the cheapest ways to provide medical care is through drugs. Even though drugs are very expensive in the beginning, it still is the case that drugs are less expensive than a lengthy hospital stay. And so if you just are like, oh, I just care about medical outcomes and what's going to be in the interest of like the broader health system, the fact that the current approval process is so expensive and it takes so long and that it discourages innovation means that who knows which treatments, which therapies, which cures could have been created had we not had this extraordinarily costly prohibitive approval process.
There's another way that drug approval policies hurt health outcomes.
The second kind of unseen cost that is still very real is drug lag. One thing that the approval process does is it prevents people from accessing potentially effective treatment. So say that a drug is approved by the FDA, hypothetical drug, and the FDA says, this hypothetical drug has been approved, and now that it's available to patients, it'll save 10,000 lives a year. Extraordinary. Say that it took, let's be generous, say that it took only 5 years to bring the drug to market, 10,000 lives per year. During that 5 years that the drug was being tested, people died waiting, right? 50,000 people could have been saved, but they were prohibited from accessing the drugs while it was being tested by the FDA.
That's University of Richmond professor Jessica Flanagan speaking recently at Duke. She also pointed to individual examples, including the case of Steve Hall.
He received an experimental cancer vaccine in 2010, and it was risky. And it might have been the case that taking an experimental, untested cancer vaccine would have killed him quickly, would have caused an extraordinary amount of pain. But he judged that it made sense for him to enroll in a trial to access this totally untested experimental therapy because that was the only thing that would give him a chance of making it to his daughter's wedding. So he had a cancer diagnosis that gave him less than a 30% chance of surviving to his daughter's wedding. And he thought, you know what? It's worth it for me to try the uncertain path because the certain path seems horrible. And so he tried this uncertain drug. He made the judgment, given his life as a whole, that taking an untested experimental cancer vaccine as his therapeutic option was the right choice for him. Other patients might have disagreed. Other patients would have said, I can't tolerate that kind of uncertainty. It's not worth it for me. How would the FDA know whether or not it's in a person's interest to take the experimental cancer vaccine for a shot at your daughter's wedding? How does a regulatory agency know what's in a person's interest as a whole? Everybody's different. Everybody's lives are different. People encounter illnesses at different points in their lives. So when we think of the FDA or we think about pharmaceutical regulators as being experts, what is the expertise that they have? They're medical experts. They know about the properties of a drug. But is that what matters when it comes to the decision to use an experimental cancer vaccine? Steve Hall is the expert about his life. Whether or not a drug is acceptably risky isn't a property of a drug. It's not as if you can like look under a microscope and be like, oh, yes, this experimental cancer vaccine, that's acceptably risky given the treatment, given what it's treating. No, that's a normative judgment. Whether or not risk is acceptable is about whether or not the risk of using a drug fits into the tapestry of a person's life in a way that makes it make sense for them to use it. But the pharmaceutical regulators, they can't tell if it's acceptably risky to use a drug or if a drug has unacceptable risks to a person's life. They don't know if somebody is holding out to see their daughter get a wedding or just trying to avoid pain. In medicine, there's a saying that says you should treat the patient, not the condition. But existing pharmaceutical regulations treat the condition, not the patient.
How would Flanagan change the current drug approval rules, rules set by the Federal Food and Drug Administration?
Here's the proposal that I would advocate for, certification. So we could have everything that the FDA does right now. So say that you're like, I love the FDA. It's my favorite regulatory agency. You're not alone. It's many people's favorite regulatory agency. They can do everything that they do right now. They can certify drugs as safe and effective. They can oversee clinical trials. They can expand the label to recertify drugs as effective as a drug's been on the market and more evidence comes in. The only thing that I'm saying the FDA shouldn't do is stand between patients and access to treatment. So imagine, you know, that we had a certification system instead of an approval system. How much would change? So would you want to purchase uncertified, unlabeled, experimental, like rando, untested drugs? Probably you wouldn't. Probably you wouldn't be like, probably you care about your health and you wouldn't be like, sign me up for that. Although maybe some of you, now that I'm thinking about my audience, maybe some of you already do, right? So people already make a bunch of decisions to use sort of unlabeled, uncertified drugs that are grown like in somebody's basement or whatever. And like they make that risk-benefit calculus themselves, but probably not more than you already do. Probably you wouldn't go to Walgreens and be like, sign me up for some untested, unlabeled drugs when a certified drug was available to treat the condition you were trying to treat. So I don't think too much would change if we just shifted to certification and approval, unless the existing system is depriving patients of accessing therapies that could benefit them.
That's Professor Jessica Flanagan of the University of Richmond discussing pharmaceutical freedom during a recent Hayek lecture at Duke University. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina is the only state in the country that automatically sends 16 and 17-year-olds charged with crimes into the adult justice system rather than the juvenile system. Now, a bipartisan group of state legislators is seeking to change that. It's a change the John Locke Foundation has been analyzing and writing about for many years now. Here to look at the Raise the Age issue is John Guzet. He is an attorney, and he is the director of legal studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
Explain current North Carolina, please.
Well, it's really just exactly what you said. The way the statutes are written, it defines adult jurisdiction to start at the age of 16, and anybody 16 years and over is an adult for all criminal justice purposes.
The two different forks in the road, so to speak, juvenile system versus adult system, are they very different?
Very different. In the juvenile system, the emphasis is on rehabilitation, and they've actually had quite a lot of success about that. It's an expensive and it's a time-consuming, intensive process, but it does seem to work for a significant number of these kids. It involves possibly detention in a juvenile detention center. It certainly involves some kind of counseling, some kind of educational efforts, including conventional high school for many who otherwise wouldn't get it. And it involves helping them after they have completed the process in terms of finding employment, finding apartments, all these kinds of things. None of that happens at adult jurisdiction. You're punished one way or another, and afterwards that's the end.
Why do some legislators want to change this?
I think the main reason is because of the evidence about recidivism. Study after study over a long period of time has come to the same conclusion, which is that juvenile jurisdiction, juvenile processing does a much better job of rehabilitation than adult processing. In fact, adult processing really amounts to being a school for crime. If you put 16 and 17-year-olds, or children at any age for that matter, if you lock them up with hardened criminals who are in their 20s and 30s, they're going to learn to become lifetime criminals. That's what seems to happen. if you get them in a juvenile system, you've got a chance at least of a rehabilitation. And the thing about reducing recidivism rates, it's not just important for the sake of these kids because it gives them a chance to become honest and productive members of society. It's important to the rest of us because lower crime rates means that we're all safer. We save money on the criminal justice system, on incarceration, on processing, on courts. And of course, we all benefit too if these kids can become rehabilitated and get jobs and pay taxes and add to the growth of the economy.
When we use the term crime, that can conjure up all sorts of different scenarios in our minds. In terms of the legality of it, John, what is the range of crime that someone can be charged with?
Well, it's vast in North Carolina. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of crimes. The ones that the main break is between misdemeanors and felonies. Felonies are the more serious crimes. They're the crimes that can be punished by a significant period of time in a penitentiary. They're also the ones that generally involve the most violence. And then even among the felonies, there's a conventional breakdown between the A through E felonies, which are considered the violent and serious crimes.
That would be things like murder.
Like rape, like a first-degree murder, like assault with a deadly weapon, and many of the higher-level drug offenses and so on as well. And then you've got the F through I felonies, which are conventionally referred to as the nonviolent felonies, and these involve things like larceny, like possession of small amounts of narcotics, like breaking and entering, things like that.
Now, because of the range of crimes that you've just described, there is not a consensus really among advocates or among legislators as to what would be the appropriate fork in the road for these teenagers to take. And that has created an interesting discussion over whether or not North Carolina should change this law. Tell us a little bit more about that discussion.
Well, that really is the focus of the debate right now. I think most legislators accept the idea that every other state in the union has raised the age from 16 to at least 17, and almost all of them have raised it to 18. Texas just did it last month. New York State did it last month. So we're left as the only state that sets the limit at 16. But there's more to it than simply deciding to raise it, and if so, to what age. The question is, do we raise it for everybody who's 16 or 17, or do we make some exceptions? Are there some people that we feel, either because they're so depraved or because they're so dangerous or because they're so incorrigible, ought to stay in the adult system? As far as I know, nobody is proposing that every 16 and 17-year-old get processed as an adult. All the proposals I've seen make some exceptions, and the question really is where to draw the line. The two main proposals that are before the legislature right now, one of them, which is based on the recommendation of a commission that was set up by the North Carolina Chief Justice, would draw the line. It would say that A through E felonies are automatically going to remain in adult jurisdiction, but everything below that will go to juvenile jurisdiction unless there's a reason. I mean, there's also a provision in that proposal that would allow the judge who initially hears the case to transfer it to adult jurisdiction for cause. And so that's important to keep in mind. But the other proposal would draw the line at the level of the misdemeanor. So 16 and 17-year-olds who are charged with misdemeanors would stay in juvenile jurisdiction, but everybody who was charged with a felony, every 16 and 17-year-old charged with a felony, would go to adult jurisdiction. That's the main debate right now, which way to go.
As the discussion has taken shape, there are some folks who are not on board with this idea of changing this. And typically what you hear is, well, there are some 16 and 17-year-olds who may have committed a lower level felony or even a misdemeanor, but perhaps they're gang members and they're dangerous to society. So where do we draw that line and between protecting society and giving a second chance?
Well, there's no perfect answer. There certainly are 16 and 17-year-olds who are a danger to society and ought to be behind bars, but we can't lock them up just because we know they're bad kids. We have to wait until they've committed some sort of crime. The general thinking here is that if we draw the line and at a point where the ones who commit the most serious crimes go to adult jurisdiction, we'll be accomplishing what we need to accomplish. But as I said, it's also important for a judge to be able to say on the basis of other factors, this is somebody who needs to be dealt with through the adult system.
Are there cost considerations to this type of change?
Yes, there are. It's going to cost some money, at least up front, because it costs more to process a kid through the juvenile system than the adult system. And we get more. As I said, this is how we managed to reduce recidivism because of this kind of intensive attention, but it costs some money. On the other hand, though, processing kids through the juvenile system saves money in the long run because they commit so many more fewer crimes throughout the rest of their lives. So we spend some money now, but we're going to reap some economic benefits down the road. And I think everybody agrees with the data on that because it's very clear.
You mentioned a few moments ago that the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, Justice Mark Martin, has taken an interest in this subject. You've followed some of his writings and his reports on this. He held recently a press conference about this. Give us a sense of his views and why he's so concerned about this.
Well, actually, this is all happening primarily because the commission that he convened 2 years ago came up with a series of recommendations for how to improve the justice system in North Carolina. This was at the top of their list. And at his press conference, he said that it's his highest legislative priority. So he's completely on board and behind this. And that speaks volumes. And the fact that the entire commission, which was made up of stakeholders from every part of the criminal justice system and the general citizenry, they all got behind it too. So there's a strong support.
And the John Locke Foundation is one of those groups that has looked at this and has said the research does show that a move should be made.
That's right. We've been advocating it for many years.
We've been talking with John Guzet. He is the director of legal studies for the John Locke Foundation. He is an attorney himself. John, thank you very much. Appreciate talking with you.
It's a pleasure, Donna.
You can read all of his analysis of this issue at johnlocke.org. Well, that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.